Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel, Kim and Chris. On today's Tour Catch-Up...
Sinner delivers to become world number two.
Collins captures biggest career title in farewell season.
And Novak Djokovic splits from coach Goran Ivanišević.
Kim, today is the 1st of April and we are here to catch up on the week in tennis at Tennis Weekly HQ. The Miami Open has come to an end with Jannik Sinner putting on the style and Danielle Collins capping a fairy tale campaign with her first ever W1000 title. Novak Djokovic has also announced a shock split from coach Goran Ivanišević, and the ATP calendar for 2025 has just been released. So we are not short of any talking points this week. And actually, I was a little bit nervous because putting the script together today, Kim, it's April 1st, it's April Fool's Day, and there are a lot of stories out there in the tennis world that it was just one big minefield.
It was. It's always like trying to claw your way through treacle with all the out there April Fool's stories that come out. I feel like also because today is a bank holiday in the UK, it's you know, there's a lot going on. We've had the clocks change. We've had lots of Easter chocolate and all sorts of things. But yeah, we've had all these April Fools on top of that. I didn't realise this until today, actually, but you can only do an April Fools before midday. So it's too late for me to spring one on you, though, Joel, sadly.
Well, one story that is very true, is absolutely true, is Chris, sadly, is not able to record with us today because he had a tennis match earlier and he went up for a smash at the net and he missed the ball and actually hit his shin with the frame of his racket. And as a result of that, he's been in incredible pain and has had to go to hospital. So he's not been able to join the Tennis Weekly trio for our latest catch up.
Do I believe you, Joel? I don't.
I tried to say that with a straight face. No, that's absolute nonsense, isn't it?
It's fortunately a lie because Chris is hopefully not in pain and he is fine. He's actually in Estoril for the tennis. So he's hopefully having a lovely time in Portugal. Although I think they've had a bit of, you know, rubbish weather when they thought it was going to be nice. But we'll be hearing from Chris and Alina later on. I have to say, though, Joel, there was an April Fool's joke which got me earlier, and I was hoping that it was going to be true. And that was that Roger Federer was joining Novak Djokovic's coaching team. Ooh. Can you imagine how cool that would be if it was actually real?
That would be like polar opposites. How would the fandoms react to such news? I mean, imagine if it was true. Yeah,
it's like someone defecting to another political party.
It's like the dark, it's like Star Wars. It feels like Star Wars. It feels like joining the dark, you know, the dark side.
Oh dear. But yeah, it is not true. It is not happening. So if I'm sure some of our listeners
is Nadal joining the Djokovic coaching team instead?
Well, no, I would hope not, but you know. Who will be joining the Djokovic's coaching team? Because he is out of a coach, which we'll get onto later on. But yeah, what's grabbed your attention this past week, Joel? You know, out of the true things that have happened and not the jokes.
Well, one thing that has grabbed my attention is something actually we were speaking about before recording, which I want to talk about in a sec. Was your tennis dream, which is another pure fantasy story, but in the actual real world, it is a story involving Roger Federer, and it was him announcing earlier this week that he is delivering the commencement speech to Dartmouth University students, which I thought was very interesting because I was always wondering, like, what would Roger Federer say? What pearls of wisdom would he offer graduation students. And I would have loved to have him at my graduation ceremony.
I might look up his rates as a motivational speaker and see if he wants to come and do something at my work.
Can Tennis Weekly bankroll it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, my regular job, I work for a charity, so maybe he might go like pro bono for us.
Yeah, I can
perhaps.
See that. I
don't
can
know.
See that. Well, I feel I went to university in Edinburgh, so I feel like Andy Murray is a more likely candidate maybe to give a commencement speech in Scotland. But yeah, I'd love to know we'll find out what Mr. Federer has to say. But yeah, I mean, is it going to be to do with tennis? Is he going to be talking about, you know, maybe he's, in my head anyway, maybe he's nervous about the possible dearth of single-handed backhands on the tour. So maybe his advice that he will pass on to any of the class will be, make sure you play with a single-handed backhand.
If you ever find yourself on a tennis court.
And maybe reaching the ATP tour, yeah.
I think it'll be along the lines of in pursuit of greatness or what have you. That was the Rolex slogan for many years, wasn't it? But yeah, Federer seems to be getting around and about quite a lot. It's quite interesting to see where he is, what he's up to in his retirement era. One place he wasn't was in my dream, because I had a really strange dream last night,
yeah,
Joel,
earlier. I don't actually think you can tell all of the dream on the episode, because it just gets so random.
Because
at one point it does involve Sara Irani, but...
And a lasagna. but I'm not going to go there. And it's not anything, you know, weird, by the way. Well, it's weird, but it's not like sort of sinister or suspicious.
What was fueling these dreams? Was it all the Easter eggs you were eating?
It might be the Easter chocolate, yeah. But basically the main context of the dream was I was in a spectator's stand that was kind of on some sand dunes, and there's a tennis match happening on the beach, but it was the Wimbledon final, but it was on a beach.
Of course,
and
Wimbledon final on a beach.
Katie Balter. Katie Balter versus Serena Williams. And it was kind of in the first set. Katie Balter was quite close to winning it. And then you turned up, Joel, and you went onto the court and you had to serve for Katie Balter. So, I woke up.
What, was Balter injured? Did she needed a replacement to make the serve, or...?
I don't know. It didn't explain that to me in my dream. But yeah, and then Sara Irani and a lasagna was kind of also in there somewhere.
I feel like Alex de Minaur would be fuming that I was going on the court to do the serve instead of him, maybe.
Yeah, she phoned you instead of him. But yeah, that was a strange dream. But actually, that's got me thinking, has any of our listeners had any weird dreams involving tennis players? Because we would love to hear them if anyone has had a really strange dream, you know, a PC dream, please, but like send them in to us. We'd love to hear them, and it would make me feel like I'm not the only one that has had some strange
dreams. I've always had dreams of making the Croydon Open a reality. That's the dream I still have close to my heart. Maybe we can make that dream a reality one day.
Maybe it can be a feature film like Wimbledon. Yes. with Paul Bettany. We can get him involved again.
Top seed at Croydon Open.
I think we should move on. Peter Colt, indeed, yes. For those of you who have watched that epic film, Wimbledon, they'll know exactly who Peter Colt is. But let's see what happened at the actual tennis, not the fantasy tennis, last week, well, over the last couple of weeks, because we have had the Miami Open, the second half of the Sunshine Double. Oh,
it has gone on, Kim. It has gone on. Well, it at least has felt like it has gone on and on. I know the rain hasn't helped, but yeah. I'm almost like breathing a sigh of relief after this because of just how long I feel like it's gone on for.
It has been, yeah, and we haven't done a catch-up for a couple of weeks, and it has been a while. But we do have two champions at the end of it, Jannik Sinner and Danielle Collins. I think one champion we expected, one we did not. Let's start with the expected champion, or one of the expected champions. Jannik Sinner, second seed. He won this title for the first time and is now up to world number two. So he continues his upward trajectory through the rankings, picking up titles. You know, he's having the most fabulous year on tour, and it's, you know, going from strength to strength. But he beat Grigor Dimitrov 6-3, 6-1 to win his first Miami Open. Very dominant performance in the final there, and, you know, throughout the week, Sinner was, you know, pretty comfortable coming through Medvedev in the semis and then Dimitrov in the final. What did you make of Jannik Sinner in Miami, Joel? Were you blown away by him? Did he convince you?
I mean, he was fantastic. I mean, the only player who gave him any sort of trouble, who took him to three sets, I think, was Talon Griegspoor earlier in the tournament. But certainly by the end of it, the way he was playing against Medvedev, where he just blew him away 6-1, 6-2, and then a similar sort of story against Dimitrov in the final, it just felt like regardless of how well or how in form his opponent was, like Dimitrov, who had earlier beaten Carlos Alcaraz in the tournament, Sinner has just been on another level. And that was the story in the final, really. Dimitrov had his moment early on in the match where he had a break point opportunity, and you thought, oh, this could be an entertaining, really thrilling match potentially. But it just shows the ruthlessness, I think, that Sinner has to him, that even that one moment, the fact that he did not take it, the match just sort of slowly unraveled for him. And anything that Dimitrov was doing that was working against his opponents en route to the final, it just was not having any success against Sinner. Particularly, I noticed, coming to the net. I mean, he was coming to net on what I would say were pretty reasonable approach shots. But, you know, Sinner's ground strokes from the back of the court were impeccable. He was doing a lot of passing shots. His backhand was great. I think I saw a statistic where, you know, he had hit zero unforced errors in the second set on his backhand wing. And it was a sight to behold.
Yeah, and Dimitrov himself had very much been a man in form over the course of the fortnight, beating Hurkacz, beating Alcaraz, beating Zverev, you know, three top players. And, you know, he'd only dropped serve, I think, twice in the run-up to the final. Yet Sinner broke him four times in that final. He just wasn't, you know, Dimitrov wasn't able to live with Sinner. Sinner just better on kind of every level, really. And, you know, absolutely the man to beat. And rightly so, he's picked up the Miami Open, which is his second ATP Masters 1000 and his third title of this year alone. And as we said earlier, he's up to number two in the rankings now, which is the highest for an Italian player. It's the first Italian to get to that level in the rankings. So yeah, he's sort of ticking off all the little milestones. And you've got to think, you know, how soon will it be before he's at the very, very top?
Well, I think one of the things now he's going to need to focus on is taking this amazing form that he's had at the start of the year on the hard courts and translating that to the clay courts, because as good as he has been so far, yeah, he needs to translate this now into the red dirt in the build up to Roland Garros and the French Open. And, you know, given the momentum and the confidence he has, you know, he's going to have his home support as well in Italy. That's going to be a sight to behold. I have no reason to doubt that he's going to be able to do this, but I think that's going to be the big challenge now, because you've got players like Carlos Alcaraz, who I think are going to feel more at home, you know, in Europe on the clay. Alcaraz has that one victory against Sinner. That's his only loss so far this year. So I think the stakes are going to get upped, but certainly he's handling it so, so well at the moment.
And you mentioned Alcaraz, who did fall to Grigor Dimitrov in the quarterfinals in Miami. Bit of a one-sided scoreline, 6-2, 6-4. It was straight sets to Grigor Dimitrov. I mean, what was the story of that match? Because I certainly didn't have that one, you know, as a result. But it may be the other way around, Alcaraz dispatching Dimitrov with that scoreline. But Grigor Dimitrov was in fine form that day, Joel. But tell, you know, what was it that made Dimitrov so dangerous in that match?
I mean, I think what I've noticed, particularly in that match and throughout the last couple of weeks, is his serve has been a force to be reckoned with. It's been so hard to break. As you talked about, he'd only been broken twice up until the final. And he's getting a lot more free points. So something to it. It's more of a threat. He's winning a lot more cheaper points, and it means that he can go and exert pressure on the Alcaraz serve. And I think Alcaraz maybe wasn't necessarily at the top of his game, and it was just a case of Dimitrov just finding that level of tennis that I think we all know he is capable of, but we just haven't seen it for, you know, so long. And you know, it was interesting to hear about the fact that, you know, through the majority of his career, he's been playing in the era of the big three, big four with Andy Murray, Pete, Stan Wawrinka. And you do wonder if playing to that level, yes, he might not have won the trophies or even the Grand Slams that he might have been afforded if those sorts of players weren't there. But arguably, he's reaping the rewards of that at the moment because it took his game to a level that it needed to be in order to compete. And now those players are either not there anymore or they're not at the level that they were, for example, like, you know, Novak Djokovic. I think he's just kind of carried on. He's gone about his business and it's now a time for him to make up where it was like a stop 4 or 5 years ago when there were just better players on the tour than him.
Yeah, I mean, he's back in the top 10 now for the first time since 2018. So it's been a long time coming. Mm. You know, he did win a Masters event back in 2017 in Cincinnati. He reached the final at the Paris Masters last year. Obviously, final here. So, and winning Brisbane, you know, which isn't a Masters, but at the start of the year. Yeah. So he's had good form for the last kind of 6 months or so. And really, you know, going up into the top 10 again. I worry that coming up against someone like Sinner in the final, you know, it's going to be the same scenario where Sinner's playing like the big three were back in the day, and Dimitrov is always going to be the kind of, you know, just missing out. Despite, you know, to a new generation. He's sort of caught in that in between. But I certainly think your point is valid with all that experience he's got from competing against the big three in their heyday has got to have held him in good stead. And he's certainly having a career with a lot of longevity because, you know, he's still going. Yeah. And he's still got, I think, a good few years left
32.
In him.
He's
32. So, which is young now.
And I think also, he got, in some regards, he got that monkey off his back earlier this year with that trophy in Brisbane, because you talk about Grigor Dimitrov, that Brisbane title, it was six years between Brisbane and his previous title on the ATP Tour. And you think about the caliber of someone like Dimitrov and you think that is a stat that just should not be happening. You almost kind of think that's an April Fool's joke if I told you that, given the level that he has played at. But you know, maybe that's taken the edge off. You know, he's got Jamie Delgado as well as his coach, who I think is working wonders as well. And it's just great to see, I think, because of the fact that earlier in his career, you felt like he was missing out on those opportunities just because there were so many better players above him on the tour. But actually, at the moment, he's making the most of it.
Yeah, and talking of Jamie Delgado, he was former coach to Andy Murray. Andy Murray had a bit of a sad time of it in Miami, didn't he? He suffered an injury to his ankle, which he's going to have, you know, he's going to be out for a while as a result of. He's had to withdraw from Monte Carlo and Munich.
I can't believe he played on.
Yeah, he played on in his third round match to Thomas Machak, despite having this injury. And it was only 2 points away from actually winning it, which is remarkable.
It was a real heartbreaker of a match, you know, not knowing the extent of that injury. You know, you felt like Murray had gone to places he hadn't gone to before this season. You know, as a Murray fan, I was like, oh my God, he's won back-to-back matches. That hasn't happened in a long, long time. And then against Thomas Machak, who's been a very tough customer on the tennis court, certainly over the last 6 to 8 months, he gave a really good go. And you know, arguably, he should have, you know, he had opportunities to get that match won. But all this news about, you know, his injury with his leg, you know, ATFL, full rupture, ligaments, these are not words you want to hear in Murray's, what looks like to be Murray's swan song season.
Yeah. However, he has said he will obviously be doing all he can to sort of see what his next steps are. And I'll quote from him, goes without saying, this is a tough one to take and I'll be out for an extended period, but I'll be back with one hip and no ankle ligaments when the time is right.
I'm not going to like him. I am nervous. The fact that there is no time scale on return. They've spoken about an indefinite time frame. Grass court season, you know, coming up. I think everyone is so keen to see him have one more Wimbledon this season. I think, you know, with the severity of the injury, it sounds like that is going to be, that's the aim of the game now. Clay season's a write-off.
Mm.
I feel like the best we can hope for now is possibly one lead-up grass court event and Wimbledon. And, you know, I think with Murray, his career, it's always been a roller coaster, and this season is, you know, no exception. What, you know, when you think he's suddenly found some form, something else happens, and you know, we'll have to wait and see. I just hope that he does get his moment to come back and be fit for Wimbledon, but there's certainly going to be a lot of nervous Murray fans up until that moment.
Yeah, we hope that he can come back and have his kind of last hurrah at Wimbledon, which I think we were kind of expecting perhaps this year as well. I mean, we had, you know, a stunner from Sinner. We've had Dimitrov going on a, you know, determined drive through the tournament. We've also had a bit of a rant from Casper Ruud out in Miami, where he was moaning about the tournament, the cheap tournament, as he's kind of called it, that the treatment of the players, the fact that there isn't anything provided. He's not happy with how the players have been kind of treated. And James Blake is the tournament director. So I guess he's ultimately responsible for providing, you know, facilities and things for the players. But Casper Ruud was not happy with him. He had a bit of an outburst on the court in his second round match against Luka Van Asch, complaining about the towel and water arrangements and calling the tournament cheap. What did you make of Casper Ruud's rant? Because normally, you know, he's quite a nice, calm guy.
Very considered
but
man.
This is a bit unlike him. He must have really not liked the towels or the lack of towels.
I wondered if there was a bit of strategy here in terms of making these complaints in this way so that it was, you know, he did it deliberately so it was kind of picked up, you know, on mic so that it would get out into the news because, you know, perhaps, you know, if they had gone through like the player council and voiced objections that way, it would have been a bit more private and it would have been a bit more under wraps and maybe nothing would have been done of it. So he's kind of gone for the more shoutier, more nuclear option of kind of doing it, basically doing it public. And I think it's quite interesting because you look at Miami from a fan's point of view, and I get the feeling it's not every fan's favorite Masters event really at the moment, because it moved from, you know, that those gorgeous facilities in Key Biscayne to this, you know, to this setup where, you know, you've got like 15 courts on some tarmac, and the stadium court is a stadium within a stadium, which again, it just doesn't feel and look right. And you're going from tennis paradise, which, you know, has had some, you know, had some, you know, challenges, you know, in the first half of the Sunshine Swing, to this. I personally think there's still a big, I don't want to say drop off, but I certainly think there's some big contrasts, I think, going on between the two. And, you know, with all the rain that Miami has had over the last couple of weeks, I do wonder, Kim, you know, I laughed it off last time, but you spoke about whether roofs should be mandated at a Masters level. And, you know, having seen what's happened over the last 2 weeks in Miami, I would tend to agree.
Yeah, I mean, we might be getting more extreme weather events as well with climate change. So perhaps the need for them increases along with that. And I think, yeah, it's a bit of a juxtaposition between what's provided at Indian Wells versus what's provided at Miami, which might make it seem worse for the players. He basically was saying that you go to a trailer for 5 minutes in a room with nothing and just a plastic chair to change. He said maybe they could put some towels, maybe some cold water for the players' comfort. So yeah, he's definitely spoken out. I mean, obviously some people might say, well, is this a bit of a first world problem? You know, you're getting paid
heat of the
lots of money
heat
to
of the moment
pay,
as well.
Play a nice tournament. Yeah. But yeah, fundamentally, obviously they should be providing water and things like that for the players.
I mean, I guess the other thing as well, Indian Wells, that's bankrolled by Larry Ellison, who is like one of the most wealthy individuals in the world. So maybe it's to be expected that Indian Wells is maybe a level above, for, you know, for players in terms of, you know, in comparison to what Miami Open is delivering. I mean, what's your point of view on that move from Key Biscayne to this setup, the stadium within the stadium? I mean, the fan point of view, what do you think about that? Because I'm not sure, but then at the same time, when I look at it on TV and I see those lovely big like sofa blue chairs around the side of the court, they look very lovely, and I'm like, oh, that looks a very comfy place to watch some tennis.
Well, yeah, it probably depends how you're going and what your personal experience is. But yeah, I it's not ever been one on my list of, oh, I must go to that event. Whereas Indian Wells, yeah, would be absolutely like a, you know, a kind of dream tournament, I guess, to go to. But Miami's never really appealed in the same way. And I, you know, I feel like some of our listeners would potentially agree with that. But at the same time, you know, if it's I'm sure Miami's a very fun place to go. So if you're there and there's a bit of tennis, then why not? But I mean, they obviously had their reasons for moving from one venue to the other. But perhaps, oh, I don't know. I'm sure Casper Ruud is probably wants the Saudis to maybe invest and make sure that every tournament provides the quality of toweling and water that he wants. Let's have a look at what went on in the women's draw out in Miami, though, because we did have a win for unseeded American player Danielle Collins, winning the biggest title of her career, defeating Elena Rybakina, the fourth seed, in the final 7-5, 6-3 on Saturday. This is kind of a dream story, really, for Danielle Collins. She's retiring this year. You know, she's kind of on her kind of final farewell. And yet here she is winning the biggest title of her career to date. At kind of out of the blue. The lowest ranked champion here at 53 in the world. And the third lowest to secure a title at this in one of the Sunshine Double tournaments as well. Joel, what did you make of Danielle Collins' week? Remarkable.
Unbelievable. It was very impressive. She spent very little time on court. You know, she just went about her business in a very easy, non-fussy way. And it's been amazing to see since, you know, the announcement that, you know, this season is going to be her farewell season. The fact that she's, you know, gone to levels of tennis that I don't think we've seen from her since, you know, she reached you know, the Australian Open lady singles final those years ago. So from that point of view, it's been amazing. And, you know, to do it in your home state in Florida, you can just see how much it meant to her. You know, when she finally got over the finish line against Rybakina, she gave an incredible speech. She was making sure that she did not leave anyone out when it came to, you know, thanking her team and her support staff. But yeah, it's just been a whirlwind couple of weeks for her. And, you know, that final against Rybakina, you know, to me, they're players who are very aggressive, but they go about it in a very different way. You know, Collins is, you know, shrieking, she's yelling, come on. She's really in your face. Whereas Rybakina is obviously a lot more reserved. She likes to keep a lid on things, just focuses a lot more on the tennis. So it was a real battle. And yeah, I'm happy for Collins because, you know, this is kind of like the, you know, aside obviously from winning a Grand Slam, this is probably the biggest thing that she could have done this season, win a W1000 title, and she's gone ahead and done that.
Yeah, and in the final, you know, Rybakina was, you know, had lots of chances to break Collins coming through, saving them. And I think, you know, we know she's so sort of determined. She plays with a lot of, you know, feistiness and saving, you know, multiple break points and kind of just, and then edging that set. Really, you know, and then it was sort of in the second set, she, you know, got managed to get the first break and away she went with it. I think it just, you know, really gritty win. And, you know, like you said, she'd kind of come through very comfortably prior to that. She played 3 hours less tennis getting to the final than Rybakina, which probably helped. You know, she was a bit fresher.
I mean, Rybakina was coming into this with, you know, an illness. She didn't play Indian Wells. And she really had to find her kind of feet coming through, just taking one match at a time. And in particular, that semi-final against Azarenka, I would actually say probably one of the matches of the season. It had everything, including a bagel as well, which you don't often see Rybakina, you know, receiving. So for her to come through that, yeah, she showed this week how much she is a battler and can come through when she's not feeling, you know, 100%. But Collins has just been, I think, just so motivated to, I think, make the most of the time she's got left. You know, it was interesting to hear. You know, there was inevitable talk on, and I feel like we're just going to hear this every time, you know, she does well in a tournament, is, oh, wouldn't you consider unretiring and playing on given the levels you're playing? Well, actually, I think the fact that she's almost made a full stop on it already, she's being like, nope, this is going to be my final season. I think that's almost kind of taken that the edge off, really. She's able to kind of focus back on her tennis, make the most of the time she has got left, and she is delivering.
I mean, she can retire and then she can always come back again in a few years' time, because, you know, she said there's so much more than just tennis in her career. It's her personal choice. So this result doesn't change her decision. But, you know, there's always, in a few years' time, she may well come back. You know, Wozniacki's back, for example. So, you know, players have done this before. They try and come back and, you know, fair play. If they want to do that, then that's their decision.
I mean, she spoke about her health and the fact that, you know, this is so much more to do than just tennis and my career. And I think that's really refreshing hearing about, you know, players putting their health, you know, their health first. I think that, you know, we see some players just take it to the absolute limit and try and push their bodies as hard as possible. And you sort of wonder, okay, where's that going to leave them, you know, post their career? So it's quite refreshing, I think, to hear these stories where actually someone like Danielle Collins has been like, look, I can't play tennis until I'm absolutely knackered, because I don't want my health to be compromised in my post-playing career. So she's almost kind of put a full stop on it and been like, right, well, let's see what I've got left and let's see what I can do.
Yeah, it's just one chapter of her life and of her, you know, her evolution away from the game, as Serena put it. But yeah, one player that, you know, has very recently returned to the tour, obviously was out of, you know, I guess not her choice, Simona Halep. She was back in Miami. She was given a wild card. She did lose to Paola Badosa in her first match in three sets. But that was her first match in a long time. And there was a bit of, you know, bit of debate, I think, amongst other players, perhaps, about whether she should have been getting that wild card. Caroline Wozniacki made some comments to say that she doesn't think players who are banned for doping should get wild cards on their return. She doesn't think it's fair. Do you agree with Wozniacki's comments there, Joel? Do you think she has a point?
I certainly think she's got a point from the position of the fact that Halep wasn't totally cleared. You know, she still had a ban in place, and she had served that ban and she had come back, but it wasn't like she was completely off kind of scot-free, and it was back on the tour and it was a mistake, and it wasn't like that. And I can see from that point of view that it feels a bit for tournaments and tournament organizers to hand out wild cards to players who, again, in this circumstance where the player has ultimately served a ban, that is a fact, does that feel right? And for some players, that is not gonna, you know, sit well. And of course, Simona Halep can come back to the tour, but it feels like they're obviously getting a helping hand, and should they be afforded that helping hand? I'm still on the fence about it, but I can certainly see why Caroline Wozniacki thinks, no, if you did that and you've served your time, fine, but you've got to make your way back up to wherever it is without anyone else's help, because, you know, you've got yourself into this position, and it's not like you're completely guilt-free given you know what was ultimately handed to her.
I shall look forward to their first match, Halep versus Wozniacki, when that's in the draw sheet, that's for sure. I mean, one player as well, a bit of a shock result, that's Iga Świątek. We thought, you know, she might have a difficult match perhaps against Linda Noskova, which, I mean,
I had Noskova winning that, and I was sort of licking my lips about, I was sort of drafting my WhatsApp message to Chris, being like, oh, I told you so, and all of that. But it was sadly, just out of reach. But yeah, next round, Alexandrova.
Yeah, Świątek losing in straight sets, 6-4, 6-2 to Alexandrova, who was the 14th seed. I did not see this one coming, I have to say.
Did anyone?
I mean, Alexandrova had beaten Świątek before. She beat her back in 2021 in Melbourne. But Świątek had won all their matches since. But Alexandrova, I mean, she was in fine form. This, you know, arguably is the best win of her career. Completely outplayed Świątek, giving her no chance to try and, you know, capture the sunshine double, and did back it up, to be fair, with a win over Pegula as well in the following round, but then ultimately falling to Danielle Collins in the semi-finals. But what do you think it was about Alexandra on that day and in her performance that Świątek had such trouble with?
I think it's a very interesting question. I think a lot of players who've got Iga Świątek in their draw will be looking at this match and thinking about what are the strategies I can take from this and employ in my match against Iga Świątek. And I think when you look at Alexandrova's game, it was very much built on first strike tennis, getting a hold of the rally. I like the way she was stepping up to serve, to Iga Świątek's serve, and you know, really trying to impose herself. I think you've got to make Świątek doubt herself and have mind games with herself. I think that's when you can kind of get her a little bit unstuck. And when you have like the power to hit flat and aggressive from the back of the court with the ball sitting low, I think that really kind of helps you. And I think we've seen that before in some of the, you know, Świątek's recent defeats. Those sorts of players, you know, like a Rybakina or a Sabalenka, when that kind of ball comes to you, the contact position with Świątek, you know, she likes to hip a bit more loopy with her forehand, a little bit more spin. When it comes in flat and low to her, it's a little bit of a different proposition. So I think those things helped her. I also think having variety helps in terms of, you know, Świątek, she is a great mover on the tennis court. But I think if you can disguise your shots and keep your opponent second guessing, it doesn't matter how good your movement is, because you might not be sure where it's going to go. Is it a drop shot? Is it going to be a cross court shot? Is it going to be down the line? And I think, again, having that disguise on your shots can help create that doubt in Świątek's mind in terms of what's coming up. And I think from that match, that's the key, is you want to make Świątek doubt herself. And I think there are plenty of ways to do that.
Yeah, well, she'll be hoping to better herself in the next tournament. You know, she'll want to do better than the fourth round, but she's going on to the clay next, which we know that Świątek thrives on the clay especially, so I'm sure she won't be down for too long. But let's take a very quick break now, after we've just discussed all of Miami. We'll be back in the second half to look at Novak Djokovic splitting with his longtime coach Goran Ivanišević, the ATP 2025 calendar being announced, and Chris will also be joining us from the Estoril Open, so do not go anywhere.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome back to the Tennis Weekly podcast. And now we're going to move on to a little quiz section to kickstart the second half. Joel, you've got a par for the courts for myself, I believe, and our listeners.
Yes, I do. This is a par for the courts solo edition for you, Kim, and our listeners. And I think it's quite tricky. I actually road tested this on my friend earlier in the week, and they did not get above 50%. So I'm giving you that as a benchmark now, as a word of warning.
Okay. Ooh, how difficult is this, Joel?
Right. My question for you and our listeners is this. As of the 18th of March, 2024, I made this earlier in the week, hence the date. As of 18th of March, 2024, there are 11 men in the ATP top 100 ranking with the name Alex or a foreign equivalent of Alex in their home country. Who are they?
So I'll just... Oh, right. That's so interesting.
So I'm just going to repeat
that. Where did you get that from?
I'm just going to repeat that for you. As of the 18th of March, 2024, there are 11 men in the ATP top 100 ranking with the name Alex or a foreign equivalent of Alex in their home country. Who are they? And I am going to set par score. So there's 11. I'm going to say above 50%. I think this is quite tough. So I'm going to say, I'm going to say 6 out of 11. I think I'm being generous. I think I'm being generous there, because I'm looking at some of these names and there are some names I'm like, these are absolute gimmies. But there are also some names in there I'll be like, Kim, I will be very impressed if you get them.
Okay, right. Let's do this. I have a few already that I'm thinking of, so at least I won't have zero. Okay, so Alexander Zverev, to begin with.
That is correct, yes. He is the highest ranking Alex Zverev. Highest ranking Alex Zverev? He is the highest ranking Alex in the top 180.
There's
rankings.
Only one of him, fortunately. Alexander Bublik.
That is correct, yes. So you've got two correct answers. Yep, two. Alexander Bublik, Alexander Zverev.
Alejandro Tabilo.
Very good, yes.
Yes.
Tabilo is on the list. So that's three correct answers.
So I need to think of Alex's that are like Alejandro kind of in their other language.
There's other ones as well. But yes, you're on the right track.
Alexi Popperin.
Very good. Yes, Alexi Popperin is on the list. So that is four.
Not
far away from par for the courts here.
Alejandro Fire, but he's retired, isn't he? I think it's Alexander Shevchenko.
That is correct. Alexander Shevchenko is on the list. So that is five answers, Kim, that are correct. You need one more to make par for the courts this week.
One more. I definitely wouldn't be able to get 11. I'm really scratching my brains now. He's Slovakian, I think, but he's got a standard Alex name. Alex Molkan?
Alex Molkan? It's incorrect, Kim! He is outside the top 100. He was 147. In the rankings. He's definitely a top 100, top 50, top, I don't know, top 30 player on his day. But he is not in the rankings in the top 100 at the moment. So unfortunately, I have to say you have not achieved par for the courts this week.
Oh, that's not unexpected. But what are the other Alexes then? You're not going to say it's like Alex Alcaraz. He's just changed his name.
Well, Kim, I'm not going to lie. There is a big name you have missed.
Big
name. And I actually said his name earlier in the episode. It is Alex de Minaur.
Oh, Alex de Minaur.
Alex de Minaur is one of the answers you could have had.
Of course.
He was the second highest ranking Alex. So Zverev, de Minaur.
He's obvious, isn't he?
Alexander
really?
Bublik, Alejandro Tabillo, another Alejandro that you could have possibly got, Davidovich Fokina.
Oh, Fokina. ADF.
Popperin, Shevchenko, and then the final four. I will be impressed, listeners, if special bonus points to you if you get any of these. Alexander Vukic.
Oh, yeah.
The American Alex Mickelson. The Frenchman Alexandre Muller.
Oh, of course.
And just sneaking in into the top 100, another American, Alexander Kovacevic.
Gosh, you could have a little tournament just with
Alex's,
couldn't you?
There you go. There you go. I mean, maybe we should. I'd love that. And Alex, an ATP Alex Battle Royale, that would be a sight to see. I mean,
well, 11% of the top 100 tennis players are Alex, so it's a good name for your kids, I think.
So there you go.
If you want them to grow up playing tennis.
Zverev, de Minaur, Bublik, Tabillo, Davidovich Fokina, Popperin, Shevchenko, Vukic, Mickelson, Muller, and Kovacevic. Listeners, let us know how you did in that Path of the Court solo edition.
I was wondering, I was thinking, is Hugo some kind of French equivalent for Alex? But no, it's Alexandre, of course. But no, thank you, Joel. Thank you very much. Listeners, let us know how you got on. Did you beat me? Did you get the obvious Alex de Menor, unlike me? But there we go. Let's have a look at what's in our mailbag now, because we've actually got, as a novelty, we've got Chris sending in a mailbag question. Chris is out in Estoril. I know. But yeah, he's not, you know, on the pod, so he's allowed to be a listener with a mailbag question today. But yeah, he sent in his question, so let's have a little listen now.
Hello, Joel and Kim. You'll be hearing from me later, but now it's time for a mailbag with a difference. I'm here in Estoril, and I want to put the question to you. With Estoril potentially being cancelled next year and more 250s being downgraded with more focus on 1,500 tournaments, is this a positive thing for the ATP and WTA Tour, or is this something that we should be sad about and that we should try and make sure that these 250 tournaments and smaller tournaments keep their places on the calendar?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question about Estoril, because the ATP 2025 calendar has just been announced. Estoril is not on it, and it just feels like we are getting to a point where there's been a lot more focus on the 1000s and the 500s. The fact that the 1000s are all becoming these 2 week events, yeah, it feels like they are becoming a lot more, you know, significant. And because of that, you know, there's got to be something that gives way somewhere, and it does feel like some of those 250s are, you know, giving way. I think, you know, Newport as well in the grass season is another one that, you know, is being erased, which is a shame. I think it's tough, because I think, you know, these 250 events, some of them just have so much heritage and prestige that goes beyond, I think, the sort of the ranking points that are like on offer. And as a result of that, I'm kind of like, I think they should stay, because, you know, they are great tournaments. I see the fans there, they absolutely love it. And, you know, I think more tournaments to me and spreading the game of tennis globally is very important. And I would arguably say more important than doubling down on your biggest events. I get it from a point of business, and we know those work and are most appealing. But I also think from a player point of view, like, you know, what happens to those players who maybe can't get into a thousands draw or a 500 draw? You know, we've spoken about how stacked some of those 500 draws are, you know, like Rotterdam, for example. I feel like you need the 250 events for some of these players to make sure that they can make a living and ply themselves on the tour, you know, 12 months of the season. So I would personally think there maybe needs to be a bit more of a balance, and at the moment it feels like we're not really getting that balance, you know, looking at the 2025 calendar, and there's a lot more focus on just what it works right at the top rather than thinking about what's at the bottom as well.
Yeah, ideally you'd have something for everyone, and that's different level of players at different rankings, as well as fans. You know, one of the tournaments that is going from next year is the Hall of Fame Open, which is the grass court event out in Newport, which, you know, I've not been to the tournament there, but I've been to the Hall of Fame. I've seen like the setup, and it's so cute. It's very quaint. It's very historic. And I love those sorts of tournaments. And they sort of seem to be getting, yeah, shunted aside for these kind of big money earners. And I get it, you know, from a business perspective, that may make more sense. But I think it is a real shame when you get some very historic events that, you know, have you know, people have great memories there, the players love them, and they're just not going to be an option. Although for Estoril, there is a bit of a possibility that it is going to remain, because it is a very, you know, highly regarded event. They've basically, the ATP have announced that the Estoril event does not hold an ATP membership, but has operated under an ATP license for the last kind of 9 years. So they are working at ways of perhaps continuing this event. So it's not the end of the world yet for Estoril Open. But yeah, it is a shame that we're going to lose some of the nice 250s that, you know, there's definitely a place for them.
It feels like there's like they have a novelty element about them that you don't necessarily get, I think, with all the big events. And I think the worry, again, one of the worries might be, is if you get rid of these 250s, like, you know, where are the lead up events? You know, it feels it's all serious all of the time with, you know, ranking points on the line, etc. The, you know, the thousands and the 500s, and you know players need to play into form as well. And I think you need to allow like flexibility in the schedule. And if you get rid of this bottom tier or shorten it or even dissolve it, you're sort of removing that flexibility and you're expecting players just to go from big event, perform at their best level. And I don't necessarily think it always works like that.
Also, there's going to be 16 500 level tournaments, but six of them are going to be in February, which seems a bit unbalanced. So I'm not sure if that's the wisest move. But, you know, we'll have to see what happens when it's all played out.
At least we have a schedule to talk about on the ATP side, because I don't know where or when that WTA schedule is going to be coming out.
Yeah, and people need to plan their year. So coaches, fans, players, everyone needs to know. So yeah, we'll wait eagerly for the WTA version. What else has been in the news, though, recently, Joel? Because we've had some news from Team Djokovic, and that is that Goran Ivanišević is no longer working with Djokovic. He was brought on in 2018 to join Djokovic's team and became his main kind of full-time single coach in 2022. They've won 12 slams together. They've been very successful, but it has come to the time where he is no longer going to be involved. What do you make of this, Joel? Do you think this might explain Djokovic's kind of disappointing start to the year? Things weren't going so well in their relationship, perhaps?
I think it's a result of the fact that things haven't been going well. And even someone like Novak Djokovic, who has achieved so much in the game, he still needs to evaluate things and assess things and change things. And I think he's got to a point where, you know, the Ivanišević in his camp has worked and been so successful over a long period of time, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's right. And I think all good things come to an end. I think we saw that, you know, previously with, you know, someone like Marin Vida in his team, who again achieved similar amounts of crazy levels of success. And we're sort of, I think, a little bit on a repeat. And I'll be fascinated to see what, you know, Djokovic does now because of the success he's had, you know, with Ivanišević in his corner. But although it feels kind of shocking, at the same time, given, you know, his form and what's been happening over the last 6 months or so, I think he's been right to be like, right, I need to stir the pot here. I need to think about, you know, how I can change things up, because whatever's going on at the moment, it's quite clear that it's not working.
Who would you recommend Djokovic brings in? Is there anyone you have in mind? Well, not Roger Federer, of course.
I personally would see if Marin Vida would take my phone call. I think you know, he knows that that relationship was very successful. And, you know, they know that they can work with each other. I know. So I think he can go back there if, you know, they still get on and, you know, they can still, you know, work together. So for me, I personally would maybe go back into the well of previous coaches and maybe go with someone like a Marin Vida.
Marin Vida was, funnily enough, I think, coaching Alex Molcan,
yes,
wasn't he?
But yes,
now that Alex Molcan is out the top 100, maybe that isn't a thing anymore.
Yeah, I think, as I say, I think to me that happened. Time has passed. Time heals all wounds, potentially. And it's time to get maybe Marin Vida back in, because if he has ambitions of going on and on to reaching, I don't know, 30 Grand Slam singles titles, for example, he's going to need a consistent, you know, support team and stability. And he just doesn't have that, you know, it feels, you know, at the moment. You know, he got rid of Vida, he's got rid of Ivanišević. He got rid of also a long-term someone in his team as well, last season. So, yeah, I think he needs stability, and I think he needs to go back to, yeah, someone he knows that he can work with.
Well, we'll watch this space. He did say that we will be informed if someone joins the team. So that's very nice of him. Thank you. But anyway, we are onto the clay swing now. Miami is over. Sunshine Double has ended. We have a plethora of clay court events happening. We've got Charleston out in the States, which is the WTA 500 event. Green clay.
There's not enough
green clay
on tour. I say this every year on the podcast. Not enough green clay events.
Well, who's going to win this one? Pegula is the top seed there, and Onjibur is the second seed. Be interesting to see how Danielle Collins does, because she's in the draw. She's got Paula Badosa first round.
Yeah,
so that could be
nightmare
interesting.
Draw. Nightmare draw, first round, Collins, Badosa, and then the winner plays the second seed, Onjibur.
It's quite a quick turnaround, though, isn't it, to go on to the clay, albeit green, from winning Miami. So, I won't have too high expectations of Collins, but obviously I'd love her to continue her run.
I think Chris, if Chris was seeing this draw right now, I think he would be seeing Maya Sharif in a 500 draw. What's that about? It's not a WTA 125.
Oh, well. Let's hope Maya Sharif can prove him wrong. We've also got out in Houston, we've got the men's ATP 250, where Ben Shelton is headlining this one. Francisco Cerundolo is the second seed. So we have that one taking place. We've got the Bogota Open, which is WTA. This is the one that Tatiana Maria has won, I think, for the last 2 years.
Did she make it a hat trick?
So, can she make it a hat-trick?
The Bogota
that would be quite
hat-trick.
Fun.
I know. And it's amazing. I mean, GB Fran Jones is in there as well. So some British interests. But I feel like all eyes on Tatiana Maria, because she just seems to play out of her skin there. I mean, the conditions that there are so unique, I think, because of the sea level and how high it is above sea level, that it's almost anyone's it's anyone's game, I think, in the draw.
We have the ATP event in Marrakesh. This is a 250. Laszlo Legere is the top seed, although my eyes are drawn to a match. Alexander Vukic versus Alexandre Muller. Battle of the Alexes.
Love it.
And Alexander Shevchenko is also there.
Berrettini as well on a protective ranking against Shevchenko. So... yeah, I'm interested to see how he gets on there. I mean, Nagal as well. Always love a bit of Indian tennis, going from strength to strength at the moment. So love to see how Nagal gets on. And Dan Evans is the third seed. So again, some more GB interest.
I'm only interested in players called Alex now, Joel. So the others don't matter.
Laszlo Legere, top seed. I feel like that takes some getting used to. Is he a top seed type player? I'm not sure.
Oh, he's going to go and win Marrakesh.
Yeah, he probably is
without
now.
Dropping a
yeah,
set
he probably,
now.
He's probably just
that.
Heard that. And he's going to go prove me wrong.
And finally, we've got Estoril, which is 250. This might be the last rendition of the tournament. Let's hope not. But if it is, Chris will be there with Alina to capture all of the magic that takes place. We do have a little clip of both of them. So let's have a little listen to them now and see what they've been getting up to in Estoril so far.
Thank you, Joel and Kim. And even though I haven't been able to listen to it yet because we are recording this live, I'm sure it's been a wonderful episode without me. But I'm joined here with Alina, who promised us that the next time that we would hear from her would be at a clay tournament in a warm country. And she delivers. We're going to Estoril.
Everything was set and ready for a clay tournament in a warm country, but little did we know, Chris, that we're going into some rain and floods. Have you seen what's going on in Iberia lately?
It looks biblical. The amount of water running down the streets, you would think it was a fully flowing river. So we thought we were getting some wonderful spring sunshine. As we're both based in Copenhagen, we thought it would be a lovely opportunity to catch a tan, enjoy some tennis. And to be honest, we might be catching a lot of rain delays and a lot of grey skies.
Exactly. Pack the umbrellas and the raincoats. Here we go.
It'll just be like a Wimbledon rain delay. But yes, we are going to Estoril, and the draw is pretty stacked. It's a great draw for a 250. It's headlined by the defending champion Casper Ruud, and also featuring another top 10 seed in the form of Hurkacz, who will be playing. We have familiar names playing in Estoril as well. We have Monfils, Fils, Musetti, and Dominic Thiem. And Alina, we have to touch upon it. You did send me an announcement video from Dominic Thiem.
Actually, once I saw it coming, popping on the socials, I was like, what is going on? Is he retiring? What is all this drama? The set, everything was like alarms. And he was very serious talking about the rumors that were going on and he needs to utilize his platforms to set the record straight.
I'm like, what rumors?
And we were like, what did we miss? what's going on? And I honestly could not breathe for the entirety of the first part. So I thought, honestly, he's going to retire, and just like dropping the news. I was like, is this it?
It was in multiple language with multiple different cameras set up. And I was thinking, so good news, not retiring. Then I kept listening, will he be in Estoril? He said yes. So for me, it was confirmation that he will be there, but that was kind of all it was. It was an RSVP to Estoril. So we will be seeing him there. We will hopefully be speaking to him there.
Let's hope we can actually ask him what was behind the big production.
What was the announcement? And can we get some of your production crew to help us on the podcast? We'll need to make sure that maybe we bring multiple camera angles. You can bring multiple languages, that's for sure. I'm not sure that I can, but the qualifiers have kicked off, but there's been some notable names already in the qualifying, Alina.
Yeah, we had the Frenchies participating. We had Lucas Pouille and Richard Gasquet, who I think he just finished his match.
A victory for Gasquet indeed. So as well as the Frenchies, it's all about the Portuguese at this tournament. And most notably, there is the home hope, probably the best hope of picking up some wins here in Nuno Borges. We also have some slightly sad news, but potentially a great story in the fact that João Sousa is actually playing his last tournament and retiring here, as well as the fact it is Estoril potentially. Well, you can maybe clear this up. Is it the last year of Estoril as well?
So much speculation went on around this. I think we touched upon it last year and we were like, okay, if this is going on, we must be there.
You said
we
book a flight, we're going. This is a destination you have to go to on the tour.
Yeah, and the speculation went around and the officials of the tournament denied the rumors until the very last moment. And boop, we had an ATP calendar coming up that actually told us the truth.
We didn't feature it. We'll try and find out more. But hopefully there will be a spot at some point in the future. But it is a wonderful tournament. We're very, very excited for it. And we have mentioned before, for all of our listeners, people know you're partial to an Argentinian. It's a bit slim pickings over in Portugal. But there's a couple of people who've made the trip. Tell us about them and tell us about who you think will have the best run.
Well, we have Fede Coria, who is having a run again. I think that might be exciting to see. He's a very thirsty player. He was in really good form in Buenos Aires. And the other Argentino that I can see in the draw
is Pedro. How do I say
Pedro Cachin?
Am I saying it right?
Pedro Cachin. Yes.
Yes.
Yes. He has different names depending on the country he's in, I think.
Yes. And depends on whether Joel Kim or I are saying it, or yourself, definitely. But again, that's another Argentinian for you to kind of keep your attention on the tournament. I will be heading early. I'm flying during what seems to be a hurricane over in a severe weather warning. So let's hope that the flight does get there. But you'll be joining me, I'm sure, for a pastel de nata courtside from Estoril. And we'll be keeping you posted. So safe flight. And do we know how I say see you in the future in Portuguese?
I don't know. We will have to figure ourselves.
We will figure it out. And if anyone's going to figure it out, it will be you, Alina. So we'll leave you for goodbyes with Joel and Kim.
It's interesting about Dominic Thiem, this big announcement. They were worrying that, oh, he's going to retire. But actually, what it was is that Dominic Thiem has announced he's going to be training with less intensity because he has had a flare-up of that wrist injury that, you know, was obviously has been career-altering for him. It's a sensible decision from his part. And actually, he has won today. So he's won his first match at Estoril against Martyra, Maximilian Martyra. So in three sets. But yeah, he's through to the second round. So it's a nice kind of opening win for Dominic Thiem. And perhaps taking that kind of step back in terms of his training will actually, you know, hopefully benefit him. But we'll see. We will see.
I just hope, because Casper Ruud is the top seed here, I hope that the towel facilities are up to scratch in Estoril, or at least maybe a little bit better than Miami.
Well, let's hope the Esther Open have upped their towel game, you know. Maybe that should be factored into the ATP calendar. Mm. Does the tournament provide nice towels? Yes. If so, you can stay. but we'll see. well, Chris can bring us all the towel gossip next week when he's back with us to catch up.
are you thinking Casper Ruud? Is he going back to 250s and is going to sort of walk this tournament? Is that the feeling?
I'm thinking Gael Monfils, perhaps.
Okay. Interesting.
I know it's clay, but he's been getting a few good wins lately. I don't know. Or maybe Musetti. Or maybe Hercash. No. Is there any Alexes in the draw? No,
Davidovich-Fekina,
so.
Is there?
There's ADF. There we go. I remember him actually playing at this event. I went to it in 2019, and it's the first time I saw ADF was at Estoril. So, yeah. Maybe it'll be
I have a random ADF memory, actually. I watched him in Queen's qualifying. They used to, I don't think they do it anymore, I'm not sure. They used to just open up the grounds for Queen's qualifying on the weekends, and I remember watching ADF on the outside courts, and he was, I just remember his racket speed and the spin getting on the ball. I was just like, this is not how you play grass court tennis, but I was still really good. It was still really good to watch him.
Yeah. Well, Queens back in the day, they did used to let you in, but they haven't been late for the qualies. It used to be a nice freebie in London.
Let's hope that changes this season. But we do have the clay swing to look forward to. The road to Roland Garros starts here. So listeners, I hope you've enjoyed our latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all the action to come from the ATP and WTA tours. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
You can also follow us on social media or email the show. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and X. Our handle is @TennisWeeklyPod. You can also purchase Tennis Weekly merch on Etsy.com/shop/TennisWeeklyPodcast. You can also email us, TennisWeeklyPod@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out our website as well, TennisWeekly.co.uk.
And we will be back next week at Tennis Weekly HQ. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Kim.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Chris. And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you again soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.